Hi, I'm Ken.
And I'm Dee.
And this is Antiques Freaks.
Time to podcast.
What antiques are we talking about this week?
This was actually an Antique Freak friend's suggestion. We're going to talk about tollware.
What is tollware?
That's a great question. Get ready for this to be one of the more vague answers you're going to get. Generally refers to painted tin. Now, the word toll comes from the French term toll peint, which means painted sheet metal, or toll peint du lac, which means painted and lacquered sheet metal.
Huh.
It's heavily based on the idea of Japanning on tin. It has come broadly to refer to any paint on tin. But to figure that out, we gotta go all the way back to the beginning. In the 1600s, Japan stopped trading with Europe for a variety of war-related reasons. And Japan had been exporting a lot of very fancy, very nice, and very useful decorative pieces to Europe. And more importantly, the sumac sap lacquer that was used to craft a lot of the Japanese decorative pieces was no longer being traded to the British. So they pretty much started to scramble around trying to mimic that. And they got exactly jackfuck nowhere for a very long time. Early 19th century Pontypool, South Wales finally cracked the code. They actually weren't trying to mimic Japanese lacquer so much as they were trying to render cheap metals free from corrosion. Tin crafting had become very big. It was cheap, it was easy, but it rusted really quickly. So they ended up coming up with a mixture of asphalt, linseed oil, and burnt umber, the base metal, not the color, which when fired turned black, just like Japanese lacquer. Since it looked like Japanese lacquer, they started painting them to mimic Japanese lacquer. So eventually, all of this ended up making its way to the American colonies. The branching here is that tollware means any painted metal, right? And so technically, it goes back to prehistory. But we're kind of talking about a specific decorative image of painted metal, which is what I am going to cling to. Classically, tollware is like black painted with decorative painting on top, right?
Sure.
Do you have like a visual memory of this at all?
No, I have no idea what the fuck we're talking about right now.
Talk about tollware.
Right, which I have never seen or interacted with in my life.
Oh, the visual representation of tollware is frequently a black background with any kind of painting, usually stenciling or one-stroke painting, and or gilding. Very commonly and very popularly, it'll be florals. Florals are seen extremely often. Once it starts getting exported to the American colonies, there's a lot of folk art and a lot of, like, family in-jokes make it a lot.
Really?
Yeah, they start getting used kind of to, like, record family histories. So, you know, there'll be paintings on these, like, tin trays that depict, like, that time Susie dropped all that corn in the field.
Oh, that Susie.
After the Revolutionary War, let's cover that base. After the Revolutionary War, when they're allowed to make tollware, because while under English control, they were not allowed to manufacture pewter or tin.
Well, no, because if they're the export, England needs them to pay for it.
Exactly.
If the colonies won't buy from England, who will buy from England? Spoiler alert, no one.
Yeah. So after they start manufacturing their own tollware, which they do mostly because it is, like I said, cheap. It's a really entry-level, like, skill for manufacturing. It's not as difficult as steel or iron or any other metal. Then you start seeing tollware kind of become synonymous with kitchen objects. Because, again, tin was really cheap and really easy to get a hold of. And you see a lot of this actually pioneered by the Pennsylvania Dutch.
Oh, hey!
And actually, a lot of tollware's, like, iconic colors and designs are heavily tied to the Pennsylvania Dutch. That kind of folk art and craft style. The Pennsylvania Dutch, of course, have a lot of really interesting, very unique to them designs. I think you know a little bit about, like, the barn symbols that are supposed to, like, ward off curses?
The Pennsylvania Dutch hex signs, yes. Sometimes erroneously referred to as the Amish hex signs, even though they are not nearly plain enough for the Amish.
Yeah, they are very pretty and interesting.
It's also interesting that, like, Pennsylvania Dutch culture is Germanic and Swiss culture kind of frozen in time because they left Europe, settled here, and then a lot of them decided, right, we're just going to keep doing things the way we've done them and not move on with the rest of the world. We're going to make a conscious choice to preserve ourselves in amber. So there's even like German words that haven't been used since like the 1600s and 1700s, but are still used by the Pennsylvania Dutch because their language has also not evolved because there is no outside influence. You call a kid a Snickelfritz in Pennsylvania, people know what you're talking about. You call a kid a Snickelfritz in Germany, no one knows what the hell you're doing and they think you're a wizard.
Yeah, I remember I was actually really surprised early on when I discovered that Tollware was something of an like a much older art, like that, you know, 1700s France, obviously, where the words come from. Because I was really familiar with country painting very much from the Pennsylvania Dutch. I was surprised to find out that Europe had ever had anything to do with it.
Well, the thing about the Pennsylvania Dutch, why they're called the Pennsylvania Dutch and not the Pennsylvanians from Pennsylvania, is because they're from Europe.
Yes.
And they're from Europe a long time ago.
Yes.
Which is why their ways are strange to us now.
This is a very important time to mention.
So it's not super shocking to me personally that their artistic tradition is reminiscent of Europe from a long time ago, but I can see where others might be confused.
This is an important time to mention that I also did not realize the Pennsylvania Dutch were German until I met you.
Right. But even if you think they're from the Netherlands is also in Europe.
I didn't think that. I actually thought that they were just country bumpkins that people had given a weird name to because of the way they lived.
The word Dutch could not possibly have any geographic or cultural connection.
I was not aware that they were immigrants.
D. I have some news for you about most ethnicities in the United States.
Well, yeah, yeah. Yeah, but like,
if you don't have, like, tribal membership, you're from somewhere else.
Yeah, but, like, England is boring, so I just sort of forget about them.
The Pennsylvania Dutch are also not from England.
Yes, but the English are also immigrants.
Yes, but, okay.
I think of them less as immigrants and more of an infestation.
Some might call an invasion.
Whereas, like, the Germans kind of came, like, not even secondarily, like, thirdly. So they actually get the immigrant status.
I mean, they came with the Hessians, but we showed them, huh?
We put them right in the river.
Oh, man. If you ever get a chance, check out the Deerfield History Museum in Deerfield, Massachusetts, where they have a splendid collection of Revolutionary War-era powder horns that have been scrimshawed by the soldiers who carried them. Some of them illustrating scenes of chasing the Hessians into the river because fuck the Hessians.
Yup.
Oh, man.
So what makes Tollware in America folk art particularly is the fact that when the pieces are produced, they aren't painted. In fact, they weren't always black lacquered or black painted. There actually were tins that had openwork punching, which just kind of means that they were decorated in a way that made them look like lattice work. And polished, and that was called poor man's silver. The painting of tinware usually happened at home after it had been purchased and brought home by, generally speaking, the women of the household. And the process was known as flowering, even if you weren't doing florals. It was called, you flowered the piece to decorate it and make it match your house.
You allowed it to bloom into art.
Exactly. I found it really fascinating. This is also a tradition in like Norway, Denmark, and Sweden. They have a variation of this, and it is still referred to as tollware, but it's all on wood, and it goes way back and actually generally had nothing to do with the rest of Europe. You can see more of that in the movie about the cult that I've forgotten the name of.
Midsommar?
Midsommar. Yeah, Midsommar actually features that pretty heavily.
The movie about the cult.
I think a lot of Swedish people were probably pretty pissed off about it.
The Swedish, I've noticed in general, don't seem particularly fussed about any depiction of Sweden.
Oh, was it just the witches that I was thinking of?
Yeah, the witches were very angry about Midsommar, but there's not a whole lot that the witches aren't angry about, if we're being completely honest.
So, tollware kind of just is a, like, really utilitarian thing. It's cheap. You can paint it to make it match your house, because, of course, you're working class. Otherwise, you'd be buying something made out of better material, quite frankly.
Whoa.
And it tends to be related to kitchen objects because of all of these same reasons. Although you do see strictly decorative elements in early French tollware, which was being made to make a statement. But I hate the French. Move on. What really gets interesting to me is the resurgence of tollware in the 1950s.
That doesn't surprise me. It's an American art form that requires women to stay in the kitchen. Of course it was popular in the 50s.
And it was cheap.
Also that.
And easily manufacturable. So it saw a resurgence for a lot of interior design reasons.
It's easy to match to.
Yeah, exactly. Like how cottage chic comes into fashion every like 15 years.
Yeah.
Because like raw wood looks good with a variety of, like, it's easy. It's easy. So you get a bunch of companies like Plymouth, Nashco, and Fine Arts Studio, all of which are just decorative studios that produce like a variety of materials. And they make specifically trays.
Specifically trays.
And the trays are all hand-painted in an assembly line kind of fashion.
I'm going to open up a Bed Bath Beyond competitor and call it just...
Nothing but trays?
Nothing but trays, that's the one.
Nothing but trays.
Nothing but trays.
But what will you sell there?
Well, here's the thing. Nothing but trays!
These are called to collectors studio trays for the obvious reason that they were made in studios and painted in a studio fashion. And a lot of them can be tied to specific artists, which is extremely desirable.
Because then you get provenance.
And then you get a provenance, yeah.
Mais ouais.
She pops off with a woman by the name of Priscilla Hauser of Tulsa, Oklahoma.
Hey!
She opens Priscilla's Little Red Toll House in 1968.
That's so charming!
And she establishes the National Society of Toll and Decorative Painters, which still exists and is now known as the Society of Decorative Painters. Priscilla Hauser, she opens this up pretty much explicitly just to teach people the art of toll painting, which is to say painting on a primarily black, although by the 50s and 60s, you saw some expansion into yellows and reds of grounds to be painted upon. And she adapts the folk painting style of, now you might actually recognize this, one-stroke painting.
I am afraid there is zero recognition, my dude. I'm sorry.
Whoa, you don't know okay, so one-stroke painting is a craft decorative painting style that involves taking specifically shaped brushes and loading them up with multiple colors all on one brush to produce, like, a depth and multicolored effect in a single stroke.
Oh.
It is very commonly used to paint flowers. It was really popular in the 80s and 90s. There used to be, like, tons of VHSs that were, like, the art of one-stroke painting. It was, like, if you go to Savers, there's a really good chance you'd find, like, a piece of glass that was painted one-stroke style.
Oh.
It actually, you know, branches off from the folk style, because folk art, by definition, is made by people who aren't versed in art.
Which I think is a bullshit definition, but sure.
Well, the definition is officially, I believe, people who are not formally educated.
Right, but then, like, how are we defining formal education?
Master.
Okay.
Master-apprentice relationship.
So, like, if your grandma's really good at it and she teaches you to do it over the summer, congratulations, you're no longer a folk artist. Like, it's fucking bullshit.
No, but you are, because you're accreditation, I guess?
Right, but then, like, what is accreditation worth?
Well, it's sounds like it's a moving target.
Yeah, exactly. So it's a useless definition.
But it's the only one we have, Ken.
Sometimes I think it might just be better to not have terms or definitions. Sometimes I think it might be better to describe an art style based on what it looks like and not the particular education background of the people making it.
Well, then I suppose you're pleased that One Stroke did get its own name.
Yes. Yes, I am.
Okay. So One Stroke is actually seen a lot in, again, the Pennsylvania Dutch. I'm going to use some phrases that are unfair to the decorative art style known as one stroke, but it is kind of a cheat to create depth and, like, visual illusion.
I was going to say, I'm very much reminded of Bob Ross.
Yeah, it's extremely Bob Ross. It's about utilizing a different set of skills to achieve depth other than the extremely, let's just call it, exhausting process traditional painters use.
But, like, all art is an illusion, particularly two-dimensional art, when you are creating the illusion of a three-dimensional image fixed in time.
Yeah.
So, like, saying one method of creating an illusion is less valid than another method of creating an illusion, if they both create the same illusion, then they're fine. It's just like the person who does it the quote-unquote easier way is smarter about it, and you're mad.
I'm not. I like one-stroke painting.
Not you personally, you generally.
Yeah. Yeah, like, I'm trying to come up with as little value-based judgment to describe it but like it evolved specifically because these people didn't have access to quote unquote like academic art instruction. Like, and Bob Ross like developed his style specifically to make those ideas easier to share.
Yeah, and frankly, he doesn't get enough credit as an artist.
Yeah, he's a fantastic artist who adapting an established system of painting to make it extremely accessible. And that is some of the beauty of folk art. And that's why, thank you, we love Tolware.
But it's not folk art because he's teaching you to do it.
No, what he's creating isn't folk art, but what that folk art's accessibility is what makes folk art beloved.
Right, but anyone who's taught by Bob Ross paints in the style of Bob Ross, so therefore paints in a folk art style, but the work they create is not folk art, despite the fact that it is visually indistinguishable from folk art.
Let us move the definition of folk art for the current moment to describe non-academic painters who are creating decorative painting for themselves.
Right, but like, we're identifying these particular antiques by the style in which they are painted, yes?
No, not just the style, we're also identifying their origins.
Right, but in order to have origin, you have to know who the artist is. Which means that if you just find one at random in a Savers or some other comparable thrift store, where you can't get the provenance because it was dumped in a donation bin anonymously in the middle of the night by a masked man, as all donations are. So there's no provenance, so therefore nothing sold in a Savers can be folk art because you didn't personally meet the grandmother who swears she didn't learn it from anybody else and just made it up out of her head.
If you could think of a better way to specify that the painting is part of a cultural working class tradition made by homemakers, then I'd all ears, but right now the only phrase I have is folk art.
I'm just saying, folk art is a bullshit term and a bullshit way of categorizing art, and I hate it a lot.
I try to use it to bring attention to, like, again, what I love about Tolware is that it was made by individuals to suit themselves.
That is beautiful.
Yeah. Like, this is Meemaw's tin bread box that she wanted to have a bunch of daisies on it, so she put the daisies on it. And, like, that is the general, like, appeal of Tolware, I think. In my opinion. That's an opinion. As someone likes Tolware for some other completely different reason, and they're gonna tear me apart. What I think is really, really cool, Priscilla Hauser is still operating Priscilla's Little Red Toll House. She actually does online classes still.
Oh my god, that's awesome.
Yeah, she does one-on-one classes. Again, she did establish the Society of Decorative Painters, which is extremely cool, very creative.
Undermining the definition of folk art, one click at a time.
Yeah. Yeah, that, okay, fine. And to be the person who single-handedly kicked off, like, a Martha Stewart-esque, like, decoration trend, I think she should be intensely proud of that.
Absolutely.
When I was little, I was very jealous of people who knew how to do one-stroke painting. It looked absolutely enchanting.
Because it's dope as heck.
I still watch ASMR videos of people doing it. It's so cool.
It is very neat and very satisfying.
So, if you're interested in collecting Tolware, the first piece of news is bad news. Because as Ken was suggesting, very little of these pieces have provenance.
Which means you may not be getting genuine folk art. Oh no!
You are getting genuine folk art regardless, but if you are an antiques collector, you probably want the older stuff.
But you can't know, if you don't know the artist, then you can't know the education of the artist, and therefore you cannot know whether or not it's folk art.
I don't think there were a lot of, you know what? The first thing you gotta consider when you're picking up a piece of Tolware is, does it matter to you whether or not the artist was academically trained?
If it does, you're going to want to get it directly from the artist or a descendant of the artist, and you're going to want to just have the kind of gullible heart that can take them at their word for it and swear they never saw a Bob Ross video.
Or, I guess, stop listening to this episode and go collect something, go collect fine art. Because it seems that might be where your interests lie instead.
It's just that provenance has never been so important as it is when you're shopping for folk art specifically, which feels like antithetical to like the entire heart of the folk art movement, which is making art you want because you enjoy it.
Yes.
I feel like folk art as a definition is broken.
Listen, man, when I'm researching this stuff, I can't take Martha Stewart aside and explain that to her.
Have we tried, though? Like, does she have an email?
No, she stopped coming to New Bedford.
Well, that's on her.
So I can't corner her and let her know.
Has she been to her vineyard recently?
No, actually. I believe she's actually taking the quarantine pretty seriously.
Oh, good for her. Hashtag thanks, Martha.
Pretty sure the vineyard has suspended a lot of travel to the island.
That's the great thing about being an island, is that you could just say, no, you can't bring the plague here. Goodbye.
But consider this. Go fucking somewhere else. So, like I said, right out the gate, one of the issues with Tollware is that it's almost never marked, the exception being studio trays, which are usually marked by the company that manufactured them. Again, Plymouth, Nashco, Fine Art Studio. Those you can track pretty easily. And although those are 1950s, and we tend to talk dunk on things when they start creeping into those eras, those specifically are really high valued just because they are made by really beautiful artists who had really nice visions, and they kind of represent an interesting point of toll history, namely the resurgence. And there are some people who only collect these studio trays.
Folk art.
So those kind of stand on their own. They're kind of in their own little separate category. The broad appeal is for pieces that have been used, were in homes, you know. And I searched everywhere. I talked to a couple of people who know about tollware. There are not a lot of great ways to determine age other than wear.
Yes, because it can be made at any time by any individual anywhere.
There are some, like, tips and tricks which I will share with you today.
Ooh.
Will actually kind of more represent materials that were on hand, which is, that's the shorthand you'll probably find yourself going back to. For example, modern, anything made from the, like, the 50s to now are done with acrylic paint, which has a specific look to it. So you're going to start having to learn the difference between acrylic paint. I don't know that they actually make egg tempera now for anything but children. Egg tempera you would be seeing up until the 1950s also has a different look, kind of like a richness of color and a particular finish. Once you start going to the 19th century, a lot of them are lacquered over, which will give them a very smooth appearance that actually kind of eliminates brush stroke.
Oh.
I've seen tons of English and European ones that are done in oil paint and then lacquered. You will actually find a lot of oil paint because it was the paint available at the time.
Just to maximize heavy metal exposure.
Just to make sure. Well, again, most of these were decorative, which means only the usable part was never painted.
Oh.
The usable part was, you know, bonded black to avoid rusting, and then was painted on the outside. So you actually don't have to worry about that too much unless it's a tray, and then just you can put the food on plates.
There you go.
And that's the beauty of stuff that was meant to be used, is that people used it. Then again, I have an unfair advantage because I studied art, so I am more familiar with the way different paints look.
Possibly the only field in which studying art gives you an unfair advantage.
I became like a bastion of information about whether or not prints were certain kinds of printing styles or originals, just because I knew what paint on a paper or a board looked like.
Exactly. And it's also made it very easy to spot those quote-unquote original paintings, where they very clearly just print out a picture onto cardboard and then go over it with a clear varnish that has random brush strokes in it that don't line up with the way the paint is actually applied.
Exactly, yes. I don't know if it was worth the price literally of admissions to be able to identify prints, but it will give you an edge, so I guess consider that when you think about college. The good thing about that is that there are a lot of art historians on the internet who are willing and ready to give you visual examples of what different paints look like at different ages. With, like, a lot of antiques, paint itself and varnishes over paint will craze. You explain this so much better than me, Ken, please.
The fine cracks that appear beneath glaze, most commonly on porcelain.
Yeah, paint gets it too. Anyone that is familiar with old oil paintings can tell you. Either the paint or the glaze will develop fine cracks. This is my go-to for defining whether or not a piece of tollware is old. And like I said, color saturation can be really important. I actually, I'm going to go ahead and say that, like, the 1980s, even in the 1950s, you didn't have, like, sort of the richness of palette in terms of acrylics that you have now. There is a quality to acrylic colors that you look at them and they look fake, and I think that's a really easy shorthand is, like, if you think that this could exist naturally and your answer is no, it's probably from the 80s onward. Very rich, very earthy colors are kind of what you're looking for. As for generally collecting, good luck. There's a lot of tollware out there. I don't know if you caught that part about how it was extremely common, easy, and cheap, so there's like tons and tons and tons of it. You might want to start narrowing down what you want to collect, or just collect whatever catches your interest. My go-to. If you're in it for value, you start looking for differences. With tollware, uniqueness is kind of the point of the day. For example, you could find reticulated edges. These are edges and handles that are punched in a decorative fashion. Very often, they are punched in kind of little diamonds so that it resembles a French porcelain woven fruit bowl.
Ooh.
You can look for unusual backing colors or ground colors. Like I said, tollware is overwhelmingly black, but you can add a lot of value to a piece if you can get it in an earth red, a gold, or a green, or a light yellow. They do tend to be earthy. They do tend to be closer to neutral. Again, this is so that they will match houses. Damage is super important. You may have divined that because it is painted, that a lot of the designs that make them interesting are damaged.
Oh no.
Since damage is kind of more of a where rather than if, what you want to see is you want to see the central motif, whatever it is, and that's easy to identify. It's just whatever's biggest and clearly meant to be the center of the image. As long as that is not damaged, it will maintain its value or has minimal damage. If the decorative elements that are kind of surrounding the central motif are damaged, this is way more forgivable. You also want to look at physical damage to the piece itself, the tin itself, including bending, warping, and like pinches in the tray. You may have noticed from your day-to-day that tin is extremely malleable material. It gets damaged very easily, and you are not likely to find a piece of tollware that isn't in some way damaged, but that's where the value comes in. If you can win the war of what has the least amount of damage, you win.
You win tollware.
You win tollware, my friend. I'm just kidding. If you have a collection that makes you smile, then you win tollware.
Aww.
Provenance becomes particularly important for these pieces. Provenance here is largely if it's connected to a name that can be identified at all.
And also, it's made up and doesn't matter.
Also, it's made up and doesn't matter. It's a kind of a no-brainer in that if it's tied to a famous family, it becomes more valuable. That kind of thing. If it is in any way provable of provenance, that is impressive and will increase value.
But again, good luck proving it, because part of the definition of folk art is that it's from anybody.
Yes. Yes, that's true. I know a guy who very specifically said that the only damage he didn't buy was wobbling.
What's wobbling?
Wobbling, like if it's a tray or a can or canister, very common, or like a bread, if you put it down and it wobbles back and forth, that is the unacceptable damage.
Oh, so it's a purely practical measure.
Usually, yeah, well, for a practical item.
I see.
Some of the absolute finest examples come from the Regency period, and these are notable mostly for not having florals. They are ships, landscapes, and various still lifes, which I suppose could include florals now that I think of it. Regency period also sees the introduction of mother-of-pearl inlay, which sort of destroys both their practical application and their cheapness.
Yeah, that does seem to kind of defeat the purpose a little bit.
Do you remember the romance of the pastoral life, but they didn't want to acknowledge the horse shit? I think it was like that.
I'm also reminded of Tiffany Solo Cups.
I think it was that. I think it was like, oh, the pearls have such fancy tinware. What if it were gold? So yeah, those specifically, the mother of pearl, landscapes, still lives that aren't strictly flowers, ships, that kind of subject matter, particularly Regency period, which can primarily be determined by the way these images are painted. Very good. Very, very money, as they say. They say very money, yeah.
They say very money.
There are also other cultural painting styles that will increase the value of a tollware piece. This is interesting. I've never seen one. I would love to see one. If you have one, please show me. A Pennsylvania Dutch specialty is thumb work, which is essentially the paint being applied and blended strictly with the pads of the fingers or thumb.
Oh.
You see a lot of ochre shapes on black work, circles on thinly painted white, and white blanks filled with flowers and fruits.
Aww.
A gentleman by the name of John Boynton, in the late 1800s, started popularizing tinware decorated with stenciling, rather than freehand painting. Yeah, that sounds like it would be easier. This is not the case. Anyone who works with stencils could also tell you.
Yeah, there are times where I've had to do an intense, intricate, repeated design, and just hand-drawing it over and over again was so much easier than trying to make a stencil.
Yep. Yep. I mean, stenciling is very similar to screen printing, where you're doing layering if you want it to look like anything. It is kind of a variation of one-stroke painting, I would say, because a lot of it is loading up the right, like, amount of color in the right order, and then, like, scraping it over the stencil. It's an art form in and of itself. It can be identified just by its crisp edges. Generally no wood or plastic. This seems unfair to the folk arts of the Scandinavian people, but I don't know anything about that. It would be a different episode. I am talking about tin, so you don't want any wood.
So you can go home.
So you can just go home until I make that episode. Generally, you're looking for bright colors.
Okay.
One of the most common ways that people fake tollware, although reproduction tollware, I don't see it. I've never seen it.
How would you know, though? Because it's folk art.
Because I went to art school and it's the one advantage it's provided me.
Ah, indeed.
I'm not confident in many abilities. I'm pretty confident in my ability to clock modern acrylic paint, even if it's been aged. Because I hate acrylic paint. That hatred fuels me. It makes me very good at it.
It's a nightmare to work with and it's a nightmare to look at.
Usually when you start doing research into an antique piece, you see a lot of... The hubbub is always about the reproduction pieces because they fuck everything up. Tollware, you don't get that because you're already in such a slog to try to figure out, like, if it's old, where it's from, what you're even looking at. I just don't think there's a lot of reproduction tollware. If there is, it will look purposefully old. You will see, like, a lot of ochre and yellow wash over it. You might even see that fake crazing applied. The key to identifying those is get good at looking at paintings.
Get good scrub.
It's all about evenness. When you're looking at aging on an actual old painting, it is almost comically, like, over-distributed and under-distributed in certain areas, right?
Right.
A fake piece is uniformly, like, faded all around. Same with fake crazing. It's these uniform cracks that almost look identical to each other. There isn't any variation. And since a lot of the older pieces of tollware were varnished, the color should still be pretty bright. Of course, the varnish can stain, it can fade, but overall, there will still be, like, a brightness that comes through it. Another thing is weight. One thing about old pieces of tin is that they were made kind of... Have you ever assembled, like, a gift box that has, like, three pieces and you have to, like, kind of fold it into itself?
Yeah.
Old tollware is like that. It's multiple pieces that were, like, welded and folded together.
Oh.
This makes it much heavier than new tinware is generally pressed out of a single piece. So it's super light. There won't be any layering to it. An old piece of tollware, just talking about the tin here, it'll be heavy. You'll find seams. There will be, like, rolled pieces, decorative rolled edges even. Almost spots of unevenness where the weight is distributed differently because of, like, areas where it's been soldered together. So that's one thing. You can just kind of get a feel for the weight of it. If it's suspiciously light, it's probably newer. And if it doesn't have any seams. Seems good, actually. On that topic, rolled edges and soldered corners. Very closely related to what I just said. But like I said, how they were constructed was pretty similar to I keep thinking back to, like, folding gift boxes. There will be areas where you'll see where the edges were kind of joined and then soldered. And rolled edges were a practical choice so that the edges of something wouldn't cut you when you were using it. Which is another thing you won't see on new pieces, because, as we discuss pretty often, when you're reproducing a piece that's meant to be looked at, nobody thinks about how it feels to touch it. I have seen some hubbub about varnish, whether or not old pieces were varnished. I don't think that that's a rule or even a reliable thing to go off of. I think some pieces were varnished in things that weren't originally made to varnish paint. And a lot of older pieces obviously weren't varnished because they were just being made by people.
Well, most things are made by people. Most things that are made are...
The trick to this is that I don't consider artists people.
Oh, okay. Yeah, that makes sense.
I have redacted my own humanity. What I'm saying is that why would you have paint-specific varnish if you don't care about painting beyond it making your breadbox look pretty? So that is where this comes from. I do think that a lot of studio pieces and other pieces, people who might have just had varnish on hand would varnish them. If someone's household did woodwork, they might have that and varnish it with that. I would go to the paint. I think the paint is more important. I think it's more common to see brush strokes, I'll say that. Again, you kind of want to see a one-stroke painting style. Some people argue with this when you're going down to, like, Regency, when we were talking about the landscape designs. That will not be the case. Those will be painted in a sort of academic fashion. So it kind of depends on individually what you're looking at. Have you heard enough of that yet? Get ready for more. I'll keep saying it. Yeah, I mean, with the floral pieces, with, like, Pennsylvania Dutch pieces, it will not be strange to see a one-stroke sort of attempt. It will be if it is a still life or a boat, for example. And even just kind of generally going back to, like, Europe and more artist-focused pieces, like, the French pieces shouldn't have any one-stroke painting. You can always tell the French pieces because they look extremely expensive and then they are priced that way.
Yes.
If you look at it and you say, holy shit, that looks fancy, that's a French piece of tollware. Easy. I nailed that one.
Boom. Done. Next.
I was curious about how to clean tollware, especially since a lot of it isn't coated. I'd never thought of it. I don't clean mine aside from dusting it. Yes, I own some.
And what?
And what? Are you going to start a fight about it? So I found this excellent advice that I wholeheartedly agree with, is that you use a soft bristled brush or cotton wool with a non-ionic detergent. Turns out that's Tide.
Okay.
And you rinse it in water and dry it, pat it dry, let it dry. And you can use microcrystalline wax to prevent any further deterioration of the painting.
Oh.
With a soft cloth. That passes my smell test for how to treat paintings. I kept seeing that you should use a Dremel machine to take off rust. No. Don't.
No.
I disagree with that.
Don't do that. Please don't Dremel the antiques.
Don't Dremel the antiques. And that is tollware.
Huzzah!
With a healthy sidebar of what is folk art?
We just don't know.
Which works, because tollware is a quintessential folk art. And interior decorators love it. You can probably make your entire business around selling nice pieces of tollware to interior designers.
Yay!
Sources today include FrenchGardenHouse.com, Weekly Favorites of Toll Trays, The Secret Life of Antique Toll Paint, and Victoria Magazine, Collecting Antique Tollware. They wrote that article. JournalOfAntiques.com, Tollware, The Poor Man's Silver. MarthaStewart.com, Did You Not Think She'd Be Here? She is.
Hashtag thanks, Martha.
Collectible Folk Art Treasures. I told you it was her fault. Dig Antiques, their April 2013 newsletter. Janvier Road at WordPress.com. Tollware, beautiful at any price.
Aww. If you would like to show us your tollware collection or just say hello, you can email us directly, antiquesfreakspodcast@gmail.com. Or you can post in our Facebook group, Antiques Freaks Friends, or tag us on Tumblr, antiquesfreaks.tumblr.com.
If you liked the number of times I said tollware, and you want to hear more and you want other people to hear more, feel free to scroll on down to wherever you're listening to this and leave us a review.
0 stars. Hate your definition of folk art.
5 stars. Thank you, Ken, for expressing what frustrates me about the term folk art.
1.5 stars. Great information on antiques, but don't give a shit about folk art.
5 stars. I hate antiques, but I love...
arguing about the definition of folk art for several hours at a stretch?
I love arguing about artistic definitions. The beauty of it, Ken, is that it takes all kinds and they'll show up.
Yay! If you would like more antique-y freaky content, such as deleted scenes, bonus episodes covering the Penny Dreadful Varney the Vampire, or video reenactments of the hit Victorian fashion guide, The Gentleman's Art of Dressing with Economy, with Drag King Guy alias, you should check out our Patreon at patreon.com/antiquesfreaks. Special shout out to our current patrons for paying our hosting fees and filling our hearts with love.
So much love.
And thank you in particular for listening.
That's right, you.
Au revoir.
Goodbye.